Okay, good morning. Good morning. So we're going to discuss one of the master Hasidic Rabbanim, and I've tried throughout the year, and I'll continue to try to open up the world of Hasidus in particular, and the world of mysticism in general to boys who haven't really been exposed to much of it. Not with a goal to turn you into mystics. That's not really where your space is right now. You have plenty of room to grow and to expand in the world of Russian and empirical Judaism, but to try to eliminate some of the imbalanced and somewhat ignorant dismissiveness towards anything that isn't rational or empirical. The world we occupy now is very empirical, but chas v'shalom to smirk or scoff at Kabbalah or to smirk and scoff at some of these stories, and it's a very, very deep tradition in Am Yisrael, the Kabbalah, Zohar, Shimon Bar Yochai, all the people that you're spending hours and hours and hours reading their ideas, trying to identify not just their knowledge of Torah, but who they were as people, 90% of them were Mekubalim. The Ramban, the Rashba, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, the Ravid. In fact, it's difficult to find Rishonim who weren't Mekubalim, the Rambam being, of course, one notable exception. So, of course, Hasidus is a modern incarnation of Kabbalah, without describing Hasidus too extensively right now. And Rabbi Yitzchak was one of the Master Rabbanim. Master Rabbanim typically live in the 18th century, before Hasidus splinters into different subgroups, and then you've got dynasties and Talmidim. Rabbi Yitzchak doesn't have any Talmidim. There's no Berditcheva Hasidim. In part, you can take it, Yaakov. In part, you can come around and get it. In part, that's because these are very, very early Hasidic Rabbanim who become the godfathers or the forefathers, the founding fathers of Hasidus. The only exception, I would say, the only member of this group of the Baal Shem Tov and Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev and people who are these master, Reb Melech of Luzansk, there's no Luzansker Hasidim, he becomes a master Rebbe. The only exception is the Tanya. The Baal HaTanya is not just seen as this founding father of Hasidus, but also has Lubavitch Hasidim that he creates a dynasty and a following of. But by and large, you're dealing with the early five or six people that you've, obviously there are many, many more than five or six, but these are the five or six that most people know of, the Baal Shem Tov, Reb Levi Yitzchak, the Maggid of Mezheritz, Reb Yaakov Yosef of Pono, Reb Melech of Luzansk, these are, and of course, the Shneir Zalman of Liadi. So let's get through some of the biographical issues, and then I want to discuss two or three points that are affiliated or associated with Reb Levi Yitzchak, and to a degree why he holds such a special place in my heart, and why I think it should in your heart, as all Hasidic Rabbanim should, but in particular where you are and who you are in life and where you are in particular in this building. Okay, he's born in 1740, just to get through the biographical notes. He's born to a father named Meir, and interestingly enough, his mother's name was Sarah Sasha, and he would very often call himself by his mother's name, Aini Levi Yitzchak ben Sarah Sasha, and you'll see why a little bit later, why this is meaningful, but there's a Kabbalah in the world of Hasidus. If you're ever in a pinch, in a difficult time, you say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, have Rachmanis on me like you had Rachmanis on Levi Yitzchak ben Sarah Sasha. So, for some reason, typically, mothers' names aren't really that influential in big rabbis' svarim, but somehow this was. Just to give you a little bit of a associative, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau of Prague, who was, of course, known as the Note of Yehuda. So one of his svarim that he wrote was named after his mother. One of his svarim was named after his father. So the Note of Yehuda was named after his father, Yehuda. And the Tzion LeNefesh Chaya, which is the Tzlach, was named after his mother, Chaya, who died early. So he made a monument, Tzion LeNefesh Chaya, which became the Tzlach. The Chavos Yair, okay, was written by a German rabbi, Yair Bachrach, in the 17th, early 18th century, I believe. So when he was a youngster, everyone would refer to him as, in Yiddish, oh, who's that little boy running around making trouble? That's, his mother's name was Chava. That's Chava's Yair. That's Chava's kid Yair. Chava's Yair. So he named the sefer Chavos Yair. And he Hebraicized the fact that he was always known as his mother's child. It's German, that's Chava's Yair. So he called the sefer Chavos Yair, based on the pasuk in the end of Bamidbar, Chavot Yair. So here's someone who always was affiliated with his mother. We'll see why. I'll try to tease it out a little bit later. Evidently, as with all great people, there's something, again, this is in the world of mysticism, so it's not like you can tell by looking at the baby that something great is happening. But the day he was born, The Baal Shem Tov called his Talmidim in and said, I'm going to give you an extra glass of schnapps or an extra cake today because a special neshama has come into this world. There are some stories. Remember, none of this is being committed to writing. There's no social media. There's all stories that are told and retold. It's hard to know which did or didn't happen, but evidently the Baal Shem Tov and the Maggid of Mezritz, the Star Talmud, which would one day become a Rebbe of Levi Yitzchak, traveled to the Bris, incognito, no one knows who they are. Chassidus Rebbeim always dressing up as commoners, and they offer to be the Moel and the Sanduk, respectively. It's hard to know where that story actually took place, but there's something special about the day that he was born. It's a cute story, and again, here's where this story is told with more data, not data empirical, because it's hard to know what's happening, but this is a story that's told more frequently. Then in the day of that Levi Yitzchak was born, so in Shamayim, the Satan is angry because the Satan comes to Kadosh Baruch Hu and says, I'm finished. I don't have any more work to do because this guy's gonna wipe the floor with me, as we would say. You know, anytime I want to try to indict a Jew, he'll find some way to defend the Jew. And Hashem tells the Satan, a cute line, don't worry, I'll make him into a community rabbi. He'll have his hands busy. He'll be too busy with politics in our jargon, and he won't get to do everything that he's capable of doing. Some sense of, but you've got the sense that heaven and earth are recognizing, forget the details of the story, heaven and earth are recognizing that this is a game changer. This is a game-changing person already from birth. Okay. He ends up learning, befriending the Prima Gadim. Thus, if you've learned, one day I'll read the Prima Gadim. He's that age. He marries an important person who then sponsors him, and he moves into his father's town, his father-in-law's town. He's sponsored to sit and learn. Ultimately, his Rebbe becomes Rav Shmelka of Nicholsburg. He learns with him before Nicholsburg. Let me just try to give you a sense of this part of his life. He's born in 1740. Between 1765, so when he's 25 years old, and 1785, when he's 45 years old, he occupies three different rabbinic positions in three different towns in Poland and the Ukraine. And why am I telling you this? Not because those towns are so notable. They're smallish towns, the largest of which is Pinsk. But in each case, he's thrown out of his position. And why is he thrown out of his position in 1765? 1765 is the heyday of anti-Hasidic sentiment amongst non-Hasidim. This is where things are really riling up. Things are really building the latter part of the 18th century. And he is victim of Misnagdim attacks, him, his family. So he gets one town to another, the Misnagdim rile up, they attack him, they attack his family. We're now in the big Hasidic Misnagdisha wars that tend to climax 1798 when the Babich Rebbe gets put into jail. That's like the climax after the Vilna Gaon dies. So he's wearing these wars on his body. He's living through this, and he's suffering because of it. And it makes his love of Jews, which we'll talk about a little bit later, even more spectacular. And I'll talk about this a little bit later. And finally, 1785, it ends. He comes to Berdichev. He becomes the Rav of Berdichev. For some reason, it stops. He's not in anyone's place or way. It's a town in the Ukraine. And then he becomes known as Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev and beloved and associated as the Berdichev of Rav. And interestingly enough, after he dies in 1809, no one ever becomes a rabbi in Berdichev. He becomes almost like they broke the mold. They can't have, like, imagine, oh, who's going to replace so-and-so? Who's going to replace the Yitzchak? And people live in Berdichev, but there's no one that becomes a rabbi in Berdichev. So 1740, he's born. 1765, he starts the rabbi in several towns. It takes him 20 years until he reaches Berdichev, and then things settle down. Okay, just one more detail before we talk about what he represented. Again, most Hasidic Rabbanim of that age and that era didn't write that much. He is an exception. He and Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi are exceptions. Shneur Zalman writes the Tanya and other works. He writes a very, very famous Sefer, which becomes a Sefer that all Hasidus reads. Anyone know what the Sefer is called? The Levi Yitzchak? Kedushas Levi. And depending upon which piece you read, it's fairly, fairly accessible. Again, some pieces, for example, if you read the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, one of the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, I own it at home. I read it, like I make it through three or four lines, then I have to put it down. There's too much Kabbalah. It's hard for me. I don't know the terms. Make believe I'm reading it. I don't really know. Kedushas Levi, some of them are like that. And I know there are terms in Kabbalah. These, by the way, when you're reading Sfas Emes as well, Sfas Emes also has a lot of coded Kabbalistic terminology. and you don't think they are because it's written so well. You just think you're reading a pshat, you know, from the VBM or something. Just kind of really double check yourself when you read these easy-ish Hasidish works. A lot of them have reference points you just may not be getting. A lot of allusions and cross links. But his Sefer Kedushas Levi is fairly understandable. I should just mention, in terms of his lineage, that he ends up learning through his Rebbe, Rav Shmelka, he becomes introduced to the Magid of Measures. The Magid of Measures was one of the Baal Shem Tov Talmidim. So that's when he gets introduced to the world of Nistar, to the world of Kabbalah. Okay. But what does Reb Levi Yitzchak represent? Two related ideas, and that's all I want to speak about today. One is, as he's known in Hebrew, the Sanegoram Shel Yisrael, the great defender of the Jewish people. Now, what does this mean? Where does this come from? Okay, so let's take a few steps back. Hasidus, as I've told you a lot in my Wednesday morning shiurim, cannot be understood in a vacuum. It is a uniquely 18th century, 19th century phenomena, because essentially the Jews have had it with Gullus. It's just been too long. It's too dark. People are too despondent. They've lost hope. They've lost interest. And the topper is Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, false Mashiach, 1666. It just devastates Jewish morale, creates tremendous tensions, struggles, murmurings, camps, divisions. It's just... if you ask me, over the 1800 years or 1700 years of Gullah, since 70 AD or maybe 150 AD, Beitar, until 1900, the worst period to live is probably the early 18th century in Eastern Europe. The poverty, the vulnerability. Again, you can live through the Spanish Inquisition, but at least the community is strong. I mean, you're facing terrible, terrible opposition, but internally... here, the internal breakdown of spirit, of any social autonomy, it's a terrible time to live. And Hasidus is trying to refresh people's spirit, offer hope, devise a mind space. How do you deal with the fact that we've been in this dark tunnel for so long and Mashiach seems farther away than ever? That's, in general, what Hasidus is trying to offer. Or Levi Yitzchak, remember, this is early on in Hasidus, this is a seminal idea. He's not just describing Mashiach and Gula, which a lot of Hasidus talks about, but he's describing the inner Kedusha that every single Jew has, which is a generality of Hasidus, and I'll tell you how he updates it. Hasidus basically creates a new role for inclusiveness. Typically, if a Jew doesn't perform religion, he's out. And in communities that are strictly woven, You're out. If you betray Torah, you betray mitzvah, so you don't perform Torah, you don't perform halacha. Again, we want to try to keep you in and be makar of you. But essentially, there's no place for the sinner. In an ideal sense, there's no place for the underperformer. You're meant to be rebuked. You're meant to do tshuva. We'll extend the hand to, you know, hopefully do tshuva. But Hasidus devises a very, very brave concept that a Jew has a deep and irremovable part of Hashem in him. And whatever he does, that doesn't affect the inner Kedusha. So in Shneir Zalman, I told you this earlier in the year, in his introduction to the Tanya, every Jew has, you're listening to me, I'll just take a departure for this. Look at me now, I'm talking to you, and I'm communicating with you, but now I'm about to communicate with you in a way that transcends speech. You ready? You have to look at me to see it. I brushed my teeth, don't worry. My exhalation is much deeper than my conversation. My conversation is wind passing through my pharynx. But my breath is coming from my diaphragm, from my lungs. That's a deeper part of me. So Hashem didn't just speak to when he created man, when he said, Vayomer yihi or Vayomer yihi mayim. When Hashem created man, Vayipach bi'apav nishmas chayim. Hashem breathed himself into man. Man de nafach mi dilei nafach. When you breathe, you're breathing from your innermost core, not just speech, which is wind through sound pipes. So that is a deep recessed part of Kedusha that can't be affected, that can't be in any way uprooted. Sin is extrinsic, casual. It's like taking a diamond and throwing it into a dirty pond or throwing it into a mud heap. The diamond doesn't lose its luster, it's just covered by dirt. And you just can buff it a little bit and the light will come through. This has nothing to do with Reb Levi Yitzchak. This is classic Hasidus. Where Reb Levi Yitzchak does is he translates this from theory into practice. Namely, Chassidus talks about this in theory, right? Everyone in this room, you have to l'recha kamocha, love every Jew. You get to the lunchroom, the Israeli next to you starts spilling his soup on you. It's hard. Some of these ideas are easier in concept than they are in practice. Yeah, I love every Jew. Yeah, try going on a bus one day and l'recha kamocha. There's this disconnect between, in theory, like I love every Jew in the Sefer, or I love every Jew that's dead, but the Jews who happen to be getting in my way and obstinate and screaming at me at the Kotel, that's a little harder. So Levi Yitzchak is able to take this concept and apply it in practice and live it and preach it with stories that seem silly. We roll our eyes, but I'll tell you some of these stories. And in ways that are especially important as the 19th century dawns, and we're just a few years away from mass defection. We're just a few years away from institutionalized defection from halacha, where Jews en masse are going to become atheists, where Jews en masse are going to become reformed Jews and no longer adherent to the halachic integrity. You don't have this yet. It's almost prophetic, prescient, but a way to deal with, and the irony is that much of Chassidus doesn't really live this anymore practically because the depletion of the ranks of halachic practicing Jews and the Holocaust created a retraction or contraction of Chassidus. Chassidus is very closed, very insular. Chassidus was never meant to be that way. It was meant to be open, embracing, inclusive, but it was just the events between 1850 and 1950 were so traumatic, and especially the Shoah to Chassidus. Remember, Chassidus suffered through the Shoah disproportionate to the rest of the Jewish population. The Shoah ripped through Eastern Europe, ripped through Hungary, ripped through Poland, ripped through, these are Hasidic centers. I don't know the numbers, but more Hasidim died per capita than others. So it was just this retreat, lets us rebuild. Entire trees of Hasidus were completely devastated and never heard from again. So it's a whole different Hasidus that you're seeing. So that is Reb Levi Yitzchak's primary association. So let me give you a few stories. Again, they sound like cutesy stories you tell kids, but when you know the background, you go back 150 years, you understand what he's trying to accomplish by just responding in ways that people would be much more negative towards. So for example, probably his most famous story, I don't know, he's walking on Tisha B'Av and he sees a Jew eating in the public square. And people, I told you the story before, and this was Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur were the days that you came out of the closet as an atheist or as a non-believer. You waited for these days. Tisha B'Av, what do I care about the Beis HaMikdash? I'm living in the Ukraine. I'm living in Poland. I'm a modern man. I'm going to sit there and cry about a temple to slit the throats of bulls. Like, ooh, Yom Kippur. It was like if you were an atheist, you waited. These were your coming out parties. So you met some atheist or some sinner walking in the street eating a ham sandwich on Tisha B'Av. And so, oh, you must not know that it's Tisha B'Av. To know, Rabbi, I know it's Tisha B'Av. Oh, you must be ill. And the doctor said, you have to eat. No, Rabbi, I'm perfect health. Oh, you must not know that it's Chazir. No, he's waiting like to make his statement. And Levi Yitzchak lifts his eyes to heaven and says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mi ki amcha Yisrael goy achad ba'aretz. Who is like your people? They'd rather be embarrassed in public than tell a lie. They're so honest. He could have easily lied to me, but he doesn't want to tell a lie, even if he has to be publicly shamed. Something like that. It's a cute story, but it's trying to find the good in people. I'll tell you my Reb Levi Yitzchak moment a few days ago. I put out a tweet. I don't know if you follow my Twitter feed. It's a good promotion, right? Has anyone ever heard of the Treif Banquet? The Treifa Banquet? Okay. The Treifa Banquet was in 1870. It had happened in Cincinnati, and it was where the Reform movement wanted to make its break. So they sponsored their first class of rabbis that they ordinated, and they had literally a treif banquet, a banquet that all the food there was treif, as people say, and it was held in Cincinnati. Cincinnati, that's where it was held. And evidently, the apocryphal story was, it was just so audacious and so abrasive that a whole bunch of rabbis ran out and said, "This is too much for us," and they formed the conservative movement. So, like, just eat, but it was kavanah. Everything had to be treif to show that we're no longer beholden to the dietary laws of the Bible and of ancient rabbinic law. As I saw on the internet a few days ago, that they had a treif banquet in somewhere in Western California, version two, where they collected all these very fancy cooks and chefs. And they had these dishes, and the dishes
delineated what was treif in the dish. It had to have something to say, this has sturgeon, and this has pork, and this has wine. Like it was a bedafka treif banquet. So it was very horrific, and it was written up in one of the newspapers, and the female rabbis who led the proceedings actually got up and made a bracha, bedafka, to make a shahako. So I tweeted essentially different responses to the treif banquet version too. In Brisk, they're saying it's against the Rambam. The Rambam says you don't make a bracha on treif food. You don't have brachas. The Musarniks are saying before you castigate those people, think about all the treif food you've made a bracha on. Namely, not about the food that's treif, but eating it inappropriately, overeating, whatever. And so, and the Hasidic response is, me Yisrael, even when they eat treif, they make a bracha. They feel close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that's the feeling that, you know, they still want to be part of Hashem, right? Even when they're eating treif, they're making a bracha. Even when they're rebelling, they can't rebel. You know, they want to feel close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Anyway, it's that sense that I get from Levi Yitzchak to find the Judaism in people that seem to be very, very distant from Judaism. Or once he came on, he saw people playing cards at Rosh Hashanah, and it was just astoundingly, you know, unimaginable of Rosh Hashanah. And he said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Miki Amcha Yisrael, they don't want to miss Tefillas Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah. They're waiting to stay up and to make sure they don't fall asleep. They're playing cards to make sure they don't miss Rosh Hashanah. Or a person once took his esrog and ruined, like, remember, in just 1 second, in Eastern Europe to find an esrog was very, very difficult. So someone took his esrog and snuck in to try to be yotze the mitzvah with the Levi Yitzchak's esrog, and he was so excited and energized that he dropped the esrog in the pit and fell. So he was like terrified to tell Levi Yitzchak that he ruined the esrog, but it took months and months to acquire him. Levi Yitzchak said, but he finally confessed, and instead of getting angry, he said, look how beautiful the Jewish people are, that they'd rather be honest, even though it'll cause mortification and embarrassment. Again, to us, these stories, we don't operate in stories. We don't operate in concepts. We talk about it conceptually and abstractly, what's the good, what's the bad. But these stories have a way of conveying someone who's able to transform this conceptual idea of the purity and the immutable purity of a Jew, not just from theory, but to practice. Avi?
Yeah,
what?
Zineborn.
Okay. Evidently, just to show the next time you choose an email name or Twitter handle, so evidently at some point the Ukrainian authorities, or the Polish authorities, I don't know who was in charge of Bordichev then, but they went around and everyone in town had to have a nickname. I guess they didn't want to call you by your family name, so you had to have some name that you'd go by, some username, I guess would be the equivalent. So he put down on the official ledgers of the local authorities, his nickname was Rachum. So he wasn't Sephardi. I mean, that would be a good Sephardi name if you lived in Tunisia or you lived in Rachamim or Rachum. He said, but his nickname was, no Ashkenazi Jews named Rachum, but his nickname was, he wanted to be like a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Ma Rachum, Afata Rachum. Now, what I find interesting about this is he's creating a way to identify or interact with Jews, not just to those who are no longer keeping halacha, but even in theory to those who are opposing. And to have someone who is so stalked and hunted and affected and assaulted by Misnagdim, his family was threatened. So evidently once, just to show you how vociferous it got and how antagonistic it got, he was once walking in the street of one of his towns, and a woman who was Misnagd came and spit at him. So he looks up at HaKadosh, you're one of these Hasidic Rebbeim. So he looks up at HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, oh, Rabbeinu Shalom, again, put it into context of the late 18th century, there's no way this woman would have been doing this without her husband's instruction, because women didn't have that type of liberty. Look at how faithful and loyal Jewish women are to their husbands. They're willing to even spit at great rabbis because they want to create marital bliss and not betray their husbands. Again, obviously in our context, nothing great about spitting, and women can do things without listening to their husbands. But in that context, it was the ability to try to see this holiness and this virtue in Jews. And this leads to a second point. It's related, but it's a little bit different. His relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because he saw himself as a defender of Am Yisrael, he created a voice with which you can interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, particularly through tefillah, but not exclusively, that isn't just, I don't deserve anything, I'm futile, I'm an inchworm, I'm embarrassed, but please save me. That's how we daven, when we daven based on myself. If I'm davening for myself, L'cha Hashem Atzdaka, V'lanu Boshes Apanim, what do I deserve? But I'm davening for Am Yisrael, and when I'm pleading the case of Am Yisrael, then all of a sudden, I can come in a much more aggressive, even litigational fashion because I am now defending people that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares about. And my whole position vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu could be different. So for example, I don't have enough, this is really a separate point, but it's really important that you get it. He once davened in Yom Kippur. A lot of these stories happen in Yom Kippur because he was also a chazan, and he would say things during tefillah that weren't in the machzor. So once on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, you better forgive Am Yisrael. Because if not, I'll tell everyone a secret that you're a liar. Why? Because what does it say in our tefillah and Shema Yisrael? What does it say in your tefillah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Mi ki amcha Yisrael goyachad baretz. You say how great the Jewish people are. If you don't forgive the Jewish people, I'll tell everyone you're a liar. That's how you talk to Hashem. Threatening Hashem. But a lot of his Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurs were litigation. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let's make an exchange. I'll give you chatoyim, you give me slicha. And I'll give you a lot of chatoyim, because we have a lot, but you give me a lot of slicha, because you have a lot. It's that tone, in particular, about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but not exclusively, that's very, very associated with Lviv. Like, let me read to you how he began 1 year Tfilas Musaf on Rosh Hashanah. This was actually put to song. It was a very famous, I'm not particularly aware of it, it was a very famous play in the Soviet Union in like the 50s around this Kaddish, put to song, that a lot of Jews were involved in. I don't know the exact details, but this is a very famous Kaddish. This is how he said Kaddish in Rosh Hashanah. You listening? Safra Tova, Rabbonu Shalom. Good morning, Hashem. Like you're entering illegal proceedings. Good morning, Hashem. Ani Levi Yitzchak ben Sara mi Bardichev. Again, I'm Levi Yitzchak ben Sara. Basi Alecha bedin Tara mitzad amcha Yisrael. I'm here to indict you on behalf of the Jewish people. Let's sit down and have a litigation. That's how you. Where's the inadequacy? Where's the humility? But you're representing Am Yisrael. Malacha Yitzel Yisrael. Why are you always commanding us and punishing us? There are many nations, I'm just paraphrasing, there are many nations in the world. There are Persians, there are Bavel, there's Rome. What do the Russians say? All they care about is their czar. What do the Germans say? They care about their Kaiser. What, this is the 18th century. What do the English people say? They care about their royalty. Vani Levi Yitzchak ben Sara, mi Bardichev Omer, Yiskadal v'yiskadash Shemei Rabba. We care about you. Vani Levi Yitzchak mi Bardichev ben Sara, Lo azuz mikan, I'm not leaving this space. Ad shiaketz, until gula comes. Ad sof hagolus. Yiskadav yiskadash merba. This is one of the most famous Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurs, but there are dozens of stories. If you went back to your Bardichev and daven Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you'd be following the Machzor, and then all of a sudden Levi Yitzchak would say something to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then turn back and continue davening. And to me, and I'll just end with one story, but before the story, this is what I find so riveting about Levi Yitzchak. Listen carefully. If you ask me what's on my bucket list when I go to Shemayim, Ritz Hashem, I would give anything to see a chavrusa between Rav Amital and Levi Yitzchak. Because these were the two things that we saw in Rav Amital. A, inclusion. But you see, we have a word for inclusion. People that aren't halachically committed, but are still part of Judaism. What do we call that? We call it secular Zionism. We know what that means, that Jews who aren't laying tefillin or aren't keeping kosher, aren't keeping Shabbos, but they're still part of us, even before they do tshuva. Reb Levi Yitzchak conceived of that 150 years before there was a state of Israel. And that to me is amazing. Rav Amital described the state of Israel for us and to us in this fashion. That's why we're not happy about secular Zionism, but that's how we partner with secular Zionism. Because we hope one day the entire country will be from and keep halacha. But those, many of you are going to go to the army, those soldiers you're going to serve with, dedicating their lives to the Jewish people, Jewish state, there's a Jewishness in them that's deeply recessed. It doesn't express itself in ritual. And Levi Yitzchak got it. Without the notion of a state. Can you imagine just living in the Ukraine in the 1800s and conceiving these ideas? It's amazing. And second of all, guys, I promise you, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that's how Rav Amital spoke to us. He'd be standing in front of us, talking to us during his sichot, and then he'd start talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we felt as if he wasn't just giving us a shmooze. He didn't talk in the way Yitzchak spoke, but he'd be speaking to HaKadosh. It would be like if you're a leader, then you also have, excuse me, but he used these terms, you have a beef with the Rabbanu Shalom. Because we're at this stage right now where we deserve to be redeemed, and enough galus, and I'm not moving until you redeem us. And that feeling of being able to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on behalf of the Jewish people, in a way that you can't speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on behalf of yourself, that Rav Amital really amplified, and that, oh, this is where he got it from. So there are two related but different issues. One is, more classically, the love of Jews, the defender of Jews. Relatedly, creating a new relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and a lot of, it's too much here, and I don't want to keep you from lunch, it's a lot of times in his tefillos that he called HaKadosh Baruch Hu father, mother. He reminded Jews that Hashem wasn't just some distant king, creator, punisher who was hidden behind curtains for 1,700 years of darkness. But he made people feel as if Hashem was their father, was their mother. And that's why he always talked about his mother, I believe. Levi Yitzchak ben Sarah's house. It was a lot of these stories are, you know, making mothers cry intentionally just to show everyone how much a mother loves it. Not hurting the mother, but not being upset with mother. Oh, you see this mother crying? That's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves you. Not daven like that. Just trying to transform Hashem into something more intimate and more identifiable as a parent. So this, I'll tell you my favorite of Levi Yitzchak's story. One year was in Elah, and he was the famous, famous chazan. People would travel from all over to hear his tefillos. And he's davening in Elah, and the sun is going down. You know that feeling. You're davening, you're looking, will we make it in time? And he stops dead in his tracks. 5 minutes pass, says nothing. 10 minutes pass, says nothing. People are getting a little antsy. They're looking at the windows and the sun's going down. 15 minutes, stone silent. Finally, a minute before Yom Kippur ends, he blurts out the end of Nila. Baruch atah Hashem, melech mocha v'sadech levoseinu, vonesam av Yisrael, umav yashmo seinu b'chol shenu v'shana, melech al kol arz, mekadish Yisrael, v'yom ha-kippur. And he finishes. Everyone gathers in the courtyard after Yom Kippur. They say, Rebbe, what happened? Like, what, that was really odd. So he says, and again, we don't process this way, but Hasidim occupy and see things through Kabbalah that we're not aware of. He says, I was davening and I saw that in Shamayim it was futile. All my tefillos were ascending to Shamayim and they were being glanced aside by the Satan. One tefillah after another, nothing was penetrating Shamayim. It's pointless. I'll offer another tefillah, it'll be deflected. Another tefillah will be blocked. It's just not getting anywhere. He says, then I remember a trick my sisters and I used to play on our mother. Our mother had a closet in which she kept all the candy. She would allocate the candy based on our merit. But when my brother and my sisters and I really wanted a candy, we'd gather by the closet, and one of us would shout out a bracha, Baruch atah Hashem shakol niyeh bedvaro, with the shame of Malchus, and my mother had to give us candy, so it shouldn't be a bracha levatala. That was a trick we played on our mother. I figured, I'll play the same trick on our Kaddish Baruch Hu. I'm going to blurt out, Baruch atah adah, Melech Mocha v'Selech, that you indeed are Mocha v'Selech. Now you have to forgive us. It shouldn't be a bracha levatal Hashem. You have to stick by the rules. That's how you daven. You're playing tricks on Hashem like he's your mother. Yeah, and Bardichev, that's how you daven. Because he really is your mother. And he wants you to play those tricks. So it's creating greater intimacy, different voice. I call it desirable chutzpah, desirable insolence. Hashem wants you to be a mechutzah when you're pleading the case of Am Yisrael. But I also want you to see it in the broader context as giving people a space, an identity, and a hope, and a relationship with Hashem in a very, very dark period. That's what people don't get about Hasidus in general, and they don't get about Levi Yitzchak. So that's on my bucket list in Shemayim. I'm so sure Rav Amital and Levi Yitzchak are having it out, like, because they're cut from the same cloth. And to me, I could only appreciate Levi Yitzchak when I first understood what Rav Amital meant to me. Okay? Have a good day, everyone.